What's up, Active Lifers? Welcome back to the Active Life Podcast. I'm Dr. Sean Pastuch. I'm your host. Today, I'm joined with Cody Ringel, lead staff at Active Life right here in Long Beach at our flagship brick and mortar. Today, we're going to be talking to you about the difference between the truth and accuracy and how if you can start to parse those things out, you'll be able to have conversations with yourself and other people that alter the way that you think, alter the way that you behave, and ultimately potentially change your entire life. Before I get to that conversation with Cody, I want to remind you that the lifeblood of podcasts is you sharing it with friends and leaving reviews. We would be eternally grateful if you would just hit that button, the pause button right now, head to wherever you're listening, leave us a review, and when it's done, send it to a friend you think would value it. That's it. Let's get to the show. Cody.
What's up?
Welcome back into the studio.
Thanks.
I say studio with air quotes because we're in my office, but it's like a studio.
Yeah. I enjoy how my title changes every time that we have a conversation.
It's funny. I need to do a better job of that because I've never been somebody who valued titles. And in our staff meeting on Wednesday, I made light of positions and titles, because I told people I stepped into the lead VP director of whatever it is of marketing role for the company. Congratulations to me, another job. But Nick, to his credit, after the meeting was over, pulled me aside and he's like, "Hey, I just want to let you know, I get it. You're not into titles. It's not that important to you. I think that you should embrace it for the sake of everybody in the company who has positions, which is everybody, because it allows for people to have clarity of how they grow in the company, the importance of different jobs, and if it was important to everybody else and they're important to you, you should make it important to you." And I thought he was 100% correct. So I got some work to do there. What is your title?
Operations lead.
Operations lead at Active Life here in Long Beach. So I was not far off.
Yeah, you're pretty close.
And we'll get accurate.
There you go.
There we go. So you talked to the team here in Long Beach who are working at the flagship about the difference between truth and accuracy. And when you did that, I thought it was profound and I thought that it was important as a message that we could share with our whole team and, of course, with people listening to the podcast. And I would love for you to kind of open up what the difference is.
The easiest way for me to speak about this is truth is subjective. Accuracy is objective. So you can extrapolate and pull that apart, right? Truth is based on a lot of things. It's based on your experience. For example, you and I driving in a car together, we pass an accident. You might look at that and take away an entirely different truth from that accident than I will, because all of the things that we've lived, all of the experiences that we've had leading up to that point, you might look at that and be like, "Oh man, I really need to make sure that I drive safe. I need to put on my belt every time I get into the car. I need to prioritize safety." I might look at that and the thing that I take away from that is how short life is and how I need to take more risks because of that. That's truth. The accurate thing is there was an accident. Mm-hmm. The truth that we derived from that is entirely based on our experiences.
So what you're saying is it's reasonable for me to see an accident like that and say, "Wow, I need to be more careful." And for that to be true to me.
Yes.
And for you to see that and say, "Wow, I need to take more chances." And for that to be true to you. And for neither of those to be specifically true to everybody. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's if you're looking for binary, right, as in right and wrong, it means that neither one of those is right. It means that they're both true to you as an individual, and it's true to me as an individual.
It's kind of like the whole, "I'm living my truth, bro."
That's a lot of where, like, you can take it down and you can think about it that way, right? And this is, once you can hold two truths, right? So when I think about how I want to communicate with people, better and how I want to understand them better. You have a truth based on your experience. And what is true for you can be true. I don't need to change that, right? You're living your truth. You're living into your truth. It's your life, your experience. I don't need to change that. It doesn't mean that I have to agree that that's accurate.
Okay. Wouldn't we then run the risk of my truth impeding on the way that you live your life if it's not accurate?
Why?
Well, let's use real life examples and bring this home for people.
Yeah.
So it's easier to hold on to. We have clients with varying needs at Active Life. And a lot of them start off with us because they're dealing with some kind of pain, physical pain, that is limiting the life that they're living. And if you ask them if their pain is really limiting their life, they would say, yes, it's 100%. It's limiting my life. And for them, that's the truth. It is. For us, in many occasions, it could be that the way that they're interpreting that pain and what they've been told by other healthcare providers, other fitness providers, their family, TV, the internet, is what has led to them making the decision that their life is or should be limited as a result of their pain. And so while that is true for them, it is not necessarily accurate that pain is what is causing them to be limited. It's the experiences and the teachings that they've gotten around their pain.
Yes. I mean, think about the understanding terminology that the education that we provide to clients, right? Insult, irritation, pain, and injury. Mm-hmm. What's the entire purpose of us educating them on the difference between those four terms?
Well, now you got to define them for the audience.
So insult is the unconscious intake of stimulus. Mm-hmm. Irritation is the conscious intake of stimulus. So right. It goes from right now, my feet are insulting the floor. My butt is insulting the chair. Once I start to think about it and I'm aware of it, then it becomes an irritation, right? Mm-hmm. My shirt is insulting my skin all day long. Once I notice it now and I tug on it and I pull on it, it's an irritant, right? The interesting thing about irritation, which we'll get to in a second, is irritation is required to drive adaptation. We need certain levels of irritation. We know this to be true across whether we want to get out of pain, whether we want to build strength, whether we want to improve our endurance. You do not, negation acknowledge, you do not improve by sitting still. Mm-hmm. So we have insult, irritation. Pain is the negative emotional response tied to irritation. Mm-hmm. Then injury is the decision that I can't. Now, one thing that's important about pain and how it ties into this conversation is that pain is exacerbated or made worse by uncertainty. Right? The first time that I stub my toe, if I'm a child running around, first time I stub my toe, it's the end of the world.
I actually saw that happen last week.
Yeah?
Yeah, not for me. I have three children in the house.
How'd that go?
Not as bad as I was anticipating, but probably because I was in a really relaxed mood in the moment. My daughter ran down the hallway and we have a chair that juts out just a little bit into the hallway and it's got the wire frame on the legs. And she kind of like caught it in between her big toe and the second toe on that. And she was just like, you saw the wind up and it was like, yeah, and then explosion. And I just took a deep breath. Walked over, can I see your toe? And so, yeah, just all that, just saw that.
So for her, that pain was heightened because it was the first time or one of the first times that had ever happened to her. Yeah. By the time she gets 10, 12, 20 times, she's going to go, ah, and keep on running around.
Interestingly enough, Kim did it like 2 days ago.
Yeah.
Same chair, different spot. So it's not the placement of the chair. It's the user error. But yeah, and she did exactly that. And it's like, oh, fuck. And then she walked it off. And the kids, of course, are like, are you okay? Are you okay? I'm like, she's fine.
Yeah, we know how this story is going to end.
Yeah.
I'm going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to, that's one of the reasons that that becomes an impactful conversation to have with clients.
Well, an injury, the last one is the decision to stop.
Right. The decision that I can't, the decision to stop. It's right. It's the, I am a knee injury, which means I can no longer live an active life. I can't do all of the things that I want to do. I can't squat. I can't
run. It would be if Kim sat down in the moment and said, I can't walk. It hurts too bad. She would have decided that she has a walking injury associated with having stubbed your toe in a chair.
Yes.
Okay. So if we acknowledge that there's that small gap between what's true, these people are in pain, and their pain is real, and the realness of their pain and the experience and the education that they've received to date is causative of them having a limited experience through life. How does them understanding and believing in accuracy being adjacent to their truth valuable?
Because it allows them to begin to see that things can be different, right? If I'm stuck in the truth that I have a knee injury, how useful is that information for me long-term? What can I do with it?
Right.
How limit can I improve
yourself.
It?
Just limit yourself.
Yeah, I eventually become the thing, right? If I have a back injury, a knee injury, what we notice with people who are injured is they become the injury, right? Mm-hmm. They start to tell the story to themselves and to other people. I would like to do that, but I can't. Why not? Well, my knee's injured. Mm-hmm. I can't go on vacation. And if I do, I've got to sit by the pool. I can't go on the hike. I can't play with the kids.
All right. Are there benches there? All of those questions.
So we start to manifest that truth into reality, because reality is, parts of reality can be subjective, right? By the story that we tell ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we start to manifest that and we create that. And what happens is we have something in our brain called the reticular activating system. And what that is that's the brain's filter, right? So it processes the millions of pieces of information that you're taking on any given second and helps you determine what is important. So right now I'm sitting here having a conversation with you while cars are passing by, while lights are on, we're in a room. The reason that I'm focused on this conversation is because of my reticular activating system. It's the thing that says, hey, here's what's important, here's what's to focus on. It also goes on a seek and find mission. So if I let it, again, going back to the injury, if I focus on the injury, I'm going to find more evidence of things that I can't do because of the injury. I'm also going to find more evidence of reasons why this is worse than I thought it might have been.
It's interesting how you describe that. I remember, I forget what podcast number, but I interviewed a gentleman named Rich DeVinny, who is a Navy SEAL commander, wrote the book, The Attributes. Great book. If you haven't read it, pick it up, especially if you're a business leader, The Attributes by Rich DeVinny. He talked about when a Navy SEAL lands after, you know, parachuting into a foreign land and releasing their chute at the absolute last available second, how they land and the first thing they do is they observe their body looking for dislocations and joint fractures, and then they start to observe the land around them, and whatever pain they might have felt from that fall is muted by the focus on something completely different. What else is going on? Where are the threats? Where are our exits? All of those kinds of things supersede it hurts, and so I can't. And I found that to be really interesting, and it's an interesting parallel that you just drew with the reticular activating system there.
Yeah, we all have it, and it all works. It can work for us, and it can work against us. One of the ways that we train the reticular activating system is with our language, right? A really great example of the RAS is, have you ever gotten a new car?
Yeah.
Right? So once you got that new car, did you start seeing it everywhere?
Everywhere. When I got... most recently, my wife and I got a Buick Enclave, right? We were really flexing on people. Buick Enclave. I remember actually I got it maybe 2 weeks before I went to a fairly exclusive mastermind that cost like $50,000 a year to be at. And I was sitting in for $5,000 deciding if I wanted to be there for the rest of the year. I walk into the room and these people all know each other. We're sharing with each other, like, check out what I just got. And it was Range Rovers, G-Wagons, Corvettes, Ferraris, Lamborghinis, Audi R8s. And they're all just showing them to each other. And I was like, I just got a sick Buick. It's 7. Thing is fly. But yes, to answer your question, when I got the Buick Enclave, it was one of those, like, I had seen it once or twice and I thought it was a cool car because it was functional for our family. It was not a minivan. It was more luxurious than like a Chevy Traverse that I saw that was on the road, and it wasn't quite as flashy as some of the other things. And I didn't see a lot of them. And then we pulled it off the lot and I'm like, these things are fucking everywhere.
There's another one, and yes, another one, and another one.
Yes.
That's your reticular activating system coming online for that, right? So if I'm injured, I'm experiencing an injury, and that is my truth, I'm going to, as I look out into the world, I'm going to look for things that I can no longer do, because that is what I'm training my brain to find.
So what you're describing is the person in pain feeling limitation looks for things that they can't do instead of looking for things that they can do, and therefore they find a myriad of things that they can't do.
Seek and ye shall find.
So how do they break free of that?
One, we can start to, well, there's a bunch of ways that we can do this. But if we're talking about accuracy, right? Let's look at the thing. What words are we using to describe the injury, mm-hmm. right? So going back to, I have a knee injury. Ask yourself a really important question here. Is that true? Well, like we talked about, if I have a knee injury, how'd you walk up the stairs?
Right.
How'd you get in here? Do you get in and out of your car?
Mm-hmm.
No. Yeah. I mean, I do all of those things. Okay. So when do you experience pain? When do you really experience that sensation? When I squat. Okay. So the more accurate language is you have a squatting injury.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So now we're applying accuracy to language. We start to look at, what can you do? Well, I can walk. I can go up the stairs. I can play with my kids. I can get on the floor, down on the floor. Is it a little bit uncomfortable? Yes, but I still can do these things. We start to retrain what we're looking for. Again, going back to the language, we know that words affect four key areas. They affect our breathing. They affect our posture, our physiology. They affect our emotions, and they affect our imagination. So typically, one of the reasons, going back to the uncertainty around pain, it gets so out of hand for people the very first time. It's not because it necessarily there's that physiological hurt and that sensation of pain. It's because I start thinking about all of the things I'm going to lose because of this and how stupid I am for putting myself in the situation to have this injury.
It almost sounds like you just experienced something like this.
Yeah. So at jiu-jitsu, right? I had something happen to my right bicep, and the story started going through my head was, okay, I know how this is going to go. I've never had this injury before, but if I were to let that spiral, it would be like, oh my gosh, am I going to have surgery? What's rehab going to look like? Did I tear a rotator? Was it a labrum? Did I break something? Was it a dislocation? Am I going to have imaging? What's this rehab process going to look like? How long am I going to be out? How fat am I going to get? Mm-hmm. How upset? How much pain am I going to be in? All of the
things. Do I have to change my diet? Am I going to stop going out with friends? Am I going to be able to sleep?
All of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's the imagination running wild.
So how do you break that? So we were talking about the difference between truth and accuracy. How does accuracy in this moment make it better?
Accuracy in this moment makes it better because if I sit with it, here's what I did when I got the injury, right? I sat with it. I breathed. I gained control of my fight, flight, or freeze response.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as it happened, you go, ah! And you go, so push the breathing down. I can now start to see clearly. Because really all we're trying to do with accuracy is we're trying to take the picture that's right in front of our face, and we're trying to move it further and further away, right? It's the old adage, you can't see the forest but for the trees.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm standing right in front of a tree, and I can't see all of the other possibilities. I can't see all of the other trees, all of the other things, because I'm too close to it. So at first, you need to give yourself some space. This is where accuracy can come in. I give myself some space from the incident, from the injury, from the issue, from whatever I'm dealing with, so that I can make a better, more logical decision.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems that we run into when our imagination runs wild, our breathing gets out of control, our emotions get heightened, is an amygdala hijack. So we lose that, the amygdala, the lizard part of the brain, the back, like the old part of the brain,
mm-hmm.
right? What happens is once that takes over, we lose our ability for rational thought. Prefrontal cortex, the part in the front of your brain that doesn't fully develop until you're 25 if you're a guy. Mm-hmm. And learn that one the hard way.
I learned that one the hard way many times.
That's our logical, our thought processing part of the brain. It actually shuts down when we get into that sympathetic nervous system. When we get into that sympathetic state, it starts to shut down because we don't need to know what 4 times 4 is when we're standing in front of a lion. Mm-hmm. We need to pull the blood to the center. We need to be able to fight. We need to fight it. We need to run from it, or we need to hide. Mm-hmm. Right? So what happens when I get in that all built up state is I lose the ability to determine, okay, what's the next best step? And all we're trying to do with gaining control of the words that we use is gain control of our breathing, posture, physiology, emotions, is make a better decision.
So what's a way that people can start to practice discerning truth from accuracy?
Look very critically at what you believe to be true. So one of the best ways that I have found to do that is to write shit down.
Okay.
Analyze your beliefs, right? Like if we're going back to the injury perspective, I have a back injury. Mm-hmm. Okay. Write that down. Sit with it. Write a story about it. Even better, what is that keeping you from doing?
So is a story a paragraph? Is it a sentence? Is it like a book?
It's different for everybody. I always encourage the people that I talk to about this to write it in as much detail as possible. Now, depending on the story and how much baggage you have with it, how many things are coming along with that, how much it's been a story for you, it may be 3 pages long. It may be a single paragraph. What you want to make sure is that you're getting it in enough detail to feel something when you see it and when you read it. I don't know what that something's going to be for every individual. Some people are going to feel anxiety when they look at it. Some people are going to feel fear. Some people are going to feel relief. But if it doesn't trigger anything in you, we're probably not cutting deep enough.
Right. So I'm imagining writing a story, a negative story.
Yes.
You're saying it doesn't have to be a negative story. It can be any story.
Correct.
Because I'm imagining writing a negative story that I would have about myself and having a hard time even writing it because of how it would make me feel to write it down on paper.
That's one of the, I mean, if we're talking about how do I change it, it's self-analysis. Mm-hmm. Without that ability to confront all of the parts of you, you're going back to your question, how do we improve it? We can't.
Right.
If you're unwilling to take the first step is awareness, right? You have to, before it's a problem, you have to know it's a problem. But for you to do anything about it, you have to step into it. You actually have to lean into it. You know, you got to go into the resistance and in order to get through it. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for some people. And if you're looking for a really practical takeaway from this, sit with a pen and a piece of paper and a 15-minute timer and just see what happens. Maybe you sit there for 5 minutes and nothing happens. Maybe on the 11th minute, the 12th minute, you're like, got it. And you start going. And there's all right answers with this stuff. You're writing a story conversationally, which means if someone were to pick up the book of Sean, they would be able to read it and understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And then what do they do with the story they wrote?
Yeah. So first step, we write out the story. Well, we title it and we write it out. Mm-hmm. Then if we're talking about the process by which I can start to create that space, step number two is you read it out loud. Now we're talking about graded exposure.
Alone.
You can. If you have someone, you know, who you can read it to, that's helpful. And that's helpful for the next 2 steps because the next step is to read it at 70% speed. That becomes important because what I notice most people will do with this story the first time through is they'll try to get through it as fast as humanly possible.
Right. Get me out of here.
Yeah. I just want to be done. So we slow it down. We let it really land for you. And this is sometimes where people will have the more emotional reaction to it. Because they're having to sit with it. They mm-hmm. got to get into it. We got to getting into the stuck or getting into the shit. 70% speed. Great. The last step, then step 4 becomes you read that same story at 70% speed. And everywhere that you have punctuation, so a comma or a period, you add a parasympathetic breath. Looks like volume on the inhale and length on the exhale. As long as your exhale is longer than your inhale, we're moving in the right direction. And the reason for this is we want to begin to separate that fight, flight response, that fight, flight or freeze, that sympathetic response of the story from the story itself, right? We want to separate the emotion from the words.
When that happens, is the outcome that you typically would see somebody looking at this or like, this isn't true?
Yes. We saw that at the live event in Boston.
I remember that.
Where we took it in a different route. We actually had him do the worst case scenario mm-hmm. of a situation. Yeah. And the first read through, it was like even the first read through, there were tears. Mm-hmm. And by the fourth, they were laughing at how ridiculous they felt it sounded.
Yeah, I remember that.
This, now it may not happen the first time through, right? I was on a call with a mentee today, and this is what we did around a situation that they were having.
Was this right after our meeting today?
Right before.
Okay.
Yeah. Around a situation that they were having. And she's like, look, I feel better about it, and I'm still worried that I'm going to have an emotional response in the moment. I said, okay. So here's what to do until you have that conversation. Read this story, 70% speed, add the breath, do it every single day up until then. Because now we're talking about graded exposure. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, the things we create in our imagination are 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times worse than the thing that actually happens. Mm-hmm. I think everybody can relate to that.
There was a Cornell study. They asked people to, I don't know what, remember the context of the situation was, but they asked people to write out what they believed the worst case scenario of their situation was going to be. And in the end, something like 87% of the time, that did not occur. You know, something else happened instead that was much less significant than severe, which just leads to it leads to what you're describing, that we like to magnify the importance of the things that we have no control over that are in our future and punish ourselves for them now when we don't have to and they're not likely to happen.
It's your imagination. And one of the things that we seem to lose sight of as adults is the power of our imagination. Mm-hmm. And what I've left people with and try to leave people with is that imagination that's making you think about the worst case scenario. That's all it is your imagination. It's the same thing that was responsible for your belief in unicorns and Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny when you were a child.
Well, I guess my kid can't listen to this one now.
If your kid was listening to the Active Life podcast, I'm giving her a high five.
Okay. She's been on it before. Yeah. So final thing I would ask you about this then is when you're done with all of that, you've read it at 70% and you observed it and you're like, I don't know. Like, it's not what I thought it was going to be, but what it was like, now what? Do they just sit with it and then rewrite the same story? Well, what's the next, like, how does that keep going?
There's typically a progression. So the next step would be, we would take specific sentences from this story, like especially the more powerful ones, the ones that really like you feel yourself tense up about, or your mm-hmm. breathing, get your breathing change, and expose yourself to those. And we'd start to do what's called a translation with those, right? So we'd start to change the structure of the sentence mm-hmm. to go from a soft sentence, like we talked about on our last one, a should detox, right? That was mm-hmm. the process that we went through, was called a translation. We took it from a soft I should to I can because.
You're talking about the lesson that we recorded together.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what we do with that then is we start to pull out some of those sentences, those key sentences, and we change them into statements of affirmation, is really what we want. Now, if you don't have a key sentence, we can still move with statements of affirmation. And I was having a conversation with Larry about this, actually. Remember that some people get weird about affirmations, right? They're like, it just feels a little woo-woo.
Well, because there's affirmations and then there's lying to yourself in front of a mirror.
Yes. So affirmations are good for two things. They're good for creating a new belief or reaffirming a previously held one. Mm-hmm. So if you need to and want to, you're like, what do I do with this now? What do you want to do? What do you want? What do you want on the other side of that? I want to be healthy. I want to be fit. I want to be able to do all of the things that I want to do and not feel limited by my pain. Mm-hmm. Write that down. Write that sentence down. Read that sentence. Expose yourself to that. Because in the same way that the story about the worst case scenario created the belief that you have about who you have to be, the way you have to act, and the person that you are who is an injury, it started with the words that you used. It started with the words that you heard, that you internalized.
Mm-hmm. Well, words that you hear that you know to be false have no impact. it's words that you hear that you think might be true are the ones that have the impact. If somebody tells you and you believe yourself to be very smart and someone's like, you're really dumb, and they're not a person who you want to hold any kind of esteem, you're like, okay, have an awesome day, man. But it's when you think, does this person actually, are they actually speaking appropriately about me and I'm misunderstanding who I am, that it starts to have an impact. At least that's been my experience.
If you have a really well-defined sense of self, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. If you're holding on to, or you haven't worked through, you know, a lot of things in your own life, your own mindset, what may happen in that is you're like, holy shit, does this person really know who I am? Mm-hmm. Because deep down, I believe that to be true.
That's something I haven't experienced.
Yeah.
So I believe you. I have a pretty strong sense of self.
That's good. It takes some people a lifetime to cultivate that.
That's a whole nother podcast, because I didn't have a strong sense of self, and then I went and found it, and that was really valuable for me. I hope this podcast was valuable to those of you listening. Remember, if it was, like, review, share with a friend who would find value in it. Cody, any last words that you want to share with people today?
Allow space for two things that you imagine oppose each other, mm-hmm, to be true.
Right, steel man both sides. I'm injured and so I can't. I'm injured and so I can.
Yes. And then seek accuracy. Use your language to seek accuracy.
Term pro.